If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Analyst Podcast. My name's Jed Hearn, author of the fantasy books Fires of the Dead and Across the Broken Stars. And on today's podcast, I'm joined by Kate Hartfield. Kate Hartfield is the author of the historical fantasy novel Armed in Her Fashion and the Alice Payne time travel novellas. She also writes interactive fiction, which is hopefully what we will be discussing today, including The Road to Canterbury and The Magician's Workshop, both published by Choice of Games. Her fiction has won or been shortlisted for the Nebula, Locus, Aurora, and Crawford Awards, and her journalism for a national newspaper award. Her novella, The Course of True Love, was published by Abaddon Books in 2016. Her short fiction has appeared in Strange Horizons, Lackington's, Podcastle, and elsewhere. A former journalist, Kate lives in Ottawa, Canada. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, I would love to discuss interactive fiction in today's interview. As you're aware, I have recently just played/read The Magician's Apprentice, and I've loved it so much that I'm on a second playthrough of it at the moment, so hopefully I turn out a bit better on this go than I did the first time around. but for those people who aren't familiar with interactive fiction, I was wondering if you could just give us a brief definition of what that is.
Right, so I take a pretty broad view of it. So any game that has a narrative component, I consider interactive fiction, which is actually most games, I think. And then on the flip side of it, any story that allows the reader to choose which way the path is going to go is also interactive fiction. So it can be everything from a video game to a tabletop game or a flowchart or one of those books like a Choose Your Own Adventure book.
Excellent. Okay, yeah, so that's a really handy interview. So yeah, like with The Magician's Apprentice, for instance, you have short scenes of like a couple of hundred words, and then people have a decision at the end of that that leads them into other parts of the story. Or in the particularly early scenes of that book, it helps to define their character. So you might give them, say, a choice of how to respond to a situation, and what happens next might be the exact same no matter what you choose, but it affects the character's attributes and everything. So, talking about the structure of The Magician's Apprentice, I'm very curious as to how you kind of prevented it from just being this decision tree that spiraled out endlessly. Because even though there are a lot of decisions to make, it does sort of arrive at like a fairly consistent endpoint. So I was just wondering if you could talk through that for a little bit.
Right, absolutely. Sorry, I'm taking off my glasses because I have an eyelash in my eye. I'm not weeping from the interview.
It's an intense interview when you start crying 2 minutes in.
Exactly. It's an inconvenient eyelash. There we go. So with the Magician's Workshop, it has what Choice of Games calls a sort of arm and fingers structure, which is that all the way along through the first 8 or 9 chapters of the game, the plot is fairly similar no matter how many times you play it. So on your second playthrough now, you may be finding that a lot of the same plot events are happening. But you're changing the character and you're changing the character's relationships and skill set and all that stuff. And there will be a few little side quests along the way that'll be different than the first time you played. But for the most part, the plot sort of stays the same. But then as you get into the final chapters, the choices that you made about who your character is will affect the choices you're able to make about what happens in the story.
Yes, and I've definitely found that. And yeah, I'm like up close to the final decision point where you have the guild coming to decide who will be the master of the workshop and everything. And yeah, I'm like very curious to see how it turns out this time.
Nice.
The setting of it is amazing, and it's the thing that really drew me to this book because, before I was a writer, I was an architecture student, so I love Renaissance era Florence. I've visited Florence as well, so it was really cool playing a story that was set in a place where I had such, I guess, like fond research and fond memories of it. What was it about the setting that drew you to it?
I think the same thing. I mean, it's such a fascinating city, especially at that time, because the game is set in 1512, which is right when the Medici family returned to Florence after having been exiled during the Italian Wars. And Machiavelli was on the outs. He had been working for the Medici's rivals, basically while they were in exile, and so he went into house arrest. And of course, there was this massive war still happening in Italy all around Florence. And at the same time, the city was full of these, for lack of another word, Renaissance men who were doing everything all at once. They were like Leonardo, inventing things and machines of war and flying machines and sewer systems and cathedrals, and they were artists. And so I thought it'd be interesting to add magic into that mix.
How do you approach research in a way that benefits the story while avoiding the trap of letting you procrastinate heaps and getting stuck in just like Wikipedia articles? Because like for me, I'm going through that at the moment with a current story, and it's like it's very easy to get sidetracked. So how do you keep focused?
Absolutely, and especially, for people like us who really enjoy research, it's easy to tell yourself that, well, you have to do it. It's all work, and sort of rationalize the hours, even when you're down the rabbit hole and you know that, you really don't need to know the details to that extent. So what I tend to do is, I'll kind of split it into two phases. So when I'm starting to just plot out a story, I'll do enough research that I feel like I know who the characters would be and the basic direction of the plot and anything I need to know who's there and what's happening and what my themes are likely to be. I'll do that level of research, but I won't, make lists about what they would have been eating or make sure that I know exactly what they would have been wearing. All of that stuff I'll leave for the most part as I go. And then as I'm going through, I'll stop and I'll do a little bit of research to figure out the details. Or what I'll do quite often is just make myself a little bracket with a note to come back and fill in. If it's a really minor detail, if it's something like, oh, I need to know whether they had this particular kind of fruit in Florence in 1512 in this season of the year, I'll just make myself a note to go back and check that.
Okay, that seems like a really good process that I'll have to implement. Yeah, so it's sort of like you get the skeleton frame of your story worked out, and then as you go along, you're like, okay, this is a thing I need to research. This is a thing, and then you move on like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So I let some of the research drive the story in the beginning. But then as I go through, I sort of let the story take over and then as it gives me my requirements for research, I'll just follow that through.
Excellent. Okay, that's really handy. How did writing The Magician's Apprentice differ from writing The Road to Canterbury, which is the previous interactive fiction game you did with Choice of Games?
I think in The Road to Canterbury, the fantasy elements were pretty sparse. They're there in a couple of ways. One of them is that the pilgrims are telling stories to each other, and some of their stories that they tell are supernatural stories or fairy tales and that kind of thing. So there are some fantastical elements because The Road to Canterbury is set. The idea is that you're on pilgrimage with Geoffrey Chaucer. And so it's almost like like the pilgrimage that might have inspired him to write the Canterbury Tales. So when the pilgrims are telling stories to each other, there's some fantastical elements. And then also you could argue that there's a speculative element to the whole thing because it's the implication is that you can change history a little bit. You can nudge it in one direction or the other through what you do with your game with the game. So it's speculative in that sense, but all the speculative elements were pretty under the surface in that game. It was, the framework of it was just historical fiction straight ahead. Whereas with Magician's Workshop, it's fantasy is baked right into the idea. So all of the magicians are are also, you know, working in this workshop as artists, as artisans, as builders, but they are also magicians. So they all have a training in alchemy and in animation, which is a sort of like necromancy, but the thing doesn't necessarily have to be dead in the story, and in soothsaying. And so those are skills just like painting or carpentry would be in the story. So it's very much, it's an alternate universe in which magic is taken for granted as a skill that anyone can learn.
Based on the experiences you had writing an interactive fiction the first time, were there any parts of the process the second time around that you did differently or better? Or I guess what I'm asking here is just how did you kind of improve your process in terms of going from that first one to the second game?
I think I was able to hold the shape of it in my head a little bit more easily with the second game. I was a little bit more used to how a choice would develop through a chapter. So I would know, okay, well, if we're going to have a conversation with this guy over here, that's going to be about 3,000 words for them to say hello and how are you, because, you know, that's how interactive fiction is. Anytime you have anything happen is 3,000 words, basically. So I had a sense of how big things had to be and what shape they would take. With the first game, I had paper all over the house with these diamond shapes and flowcharts and things, trying to figure out, okay, if you do this, this happens. If you do that, this other thing happens. With the Magician's Workshop, I was able to conceptualize it a little bit more in my head and just go through like that. But I think also there was a little bit of a false sense of security in a way, because with the second game, I thought, okay, well, now I know what I'm doing. You know, like I wrote this game, now I know. And I got myself into a bit of trouble because I didn't really plan it and outline it as much as I probably should have. And so there were some chapters where I knew the basics of what was going to happen, but I said, oh, you know, it'll be clear as I go through or whatever. And you can't really do that with interactive fiction as easily as you can with linear fiction. Because, you know, every time you make a choice as a writer, you know, that is a huge chunk of writing that you then have to commit to, basically. So tweaking as you go is not as easy when you're doing interactive stuff.
Fair enough. So that's interesting to me, because, yeah, I would have assumed that you would just have, like, a whole bunch of index cards and sort of, like, you know, that kind of classic crazy detective who has a big pin board and just all bits of string leading between them and that. But it's interesting that you were able to go from a similar process to that in the first book to being able to, like, have it all conceptualized mentally in the second. That's fascinating to me. That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so,
it's a neat process.
Oh, sorry, keep going. Yeah, so like, oh, sorry, I kept cutting across you then. Were you saying something, sir?
No.
Excellent. I just got like really excited by that, because it's always, I suppose one of the things I find fascinating in these author interviews is when you talk to other authors and you have like a very, I suppose you have like a conception of how you think their process must be because of the complexity of their stories, for instance. And then they tell you that, oh no, I just like have it all in my head and it just all comes out of somehow, and I'm in awe of that because I'm a very big outliner. So yeah, I need to have all the notes down beforehand. What would be your, like, pulling back a bit from that very specific interactive fiction question, what would be your advice for someone who is about to write their first interactive fiction game?
Definitely keep it small, because you know, a small idea will be bigger once you start working on it, you know, for the reasons that I've said, that everything, you know, if you're writing tripartite choices, then everything you write is going to have three versions. So, you know, even if a small, a little story that would be 5,000 words, 6,000 words in linear fiction is probably more like a 1,000-word story in interactive fiction. So the same, that size of idea, if that makes sense. Yeah. So making sure that the idea is not bigger than you can handle, and having a sense before you start of the kind of philosophy that you want to have in the game. What kind of agency do you want the player to have? You know, a choice of games has some guidelines for that sort of thing. They have a sort of philosophy of gaming that they help when you're actually working on a choice of games product, they'll help you with. But even there, there's a lot of latitude, and for someone who just wants to start fooling around in Twine or something like that to make interactive fiction, I think even still you have to start by thinking, okay, do I want the player to actually be able to affect things? Do I want the player to meet a sticky end that's unsatisfying halfway through? Or do I want them not to have that happen? Do I want them to be surprised by choices that are moral choices that they don't have a say in? Because that's a huge choice as an author, because when you're actually interacting with the game, it's different than reading a story in a sense. And if you find that the game is forcing you into a decision you don't want to make, that's not bad necessarily, but it's something as an author you have to consider that you wouldn't necessarily consider when you're writing linear fiction.
With The Magician's Workshop, is it possible for the character to like die during the middle of the story? Or is it a thing where you just always get to the end?
You always get to the end in that one, yeah.
With
Road to Canterbury, there is a way that you can die in Chapter 9, I think it is.
Oh, that's very specific. But I'll be worried about that when we get to Chapter 9 now.
Yeah. But with The Magician's Workshop, no, I'm pretty sure there's no, if I recall correctly, there's no way you can die. There's a wide variety of sort of statuses you can have at the end of the game, but none of them is dead. So, yeah.
Because I found that an interesting choice, because like there were a lot of times when I first played it where I was like, oh, this is like an evil magic thing that's like haunting me. I feel in mortal peril here. And then it's like sort of at the end you realize like, oh, this is less a game about survival and more a game about like something that's a bit more complex, and that's negotiating all these different relationships between characters and balancing your own skill sets and everything, and kind of like, I suppose, with real life, you don't really know how it ends up until the end of it, which is very fascinating. How do you, this is a very nitty-gritty procedural question, but I'm asking this as someone who is interested in probably writing interactive fiction one day. How do you, like, use... Because I know that in the game, there's like a little tab you can go into which has all the statistics of characters and stuff. And in terms of your traits and everything, they're all in there. How do you use those to inform the scenes that are happening in the game?
It's nice to give player a little bit of feedback that those choices are actually mattering, because, as I said, the plot doesn't really change in a dramatic way until the end. But even so, you want to have a sense that your choice is actually affecting what's happening in the game. So you can do that without writing huge side quests, just by changing little things about how people respond to you, for example. So if you've been having a sort of fraught relationship with a character, that character will be a little bit snippy towards you. And it might just be a difference of a few words, but just considering those little things as you go along, remembering that each player is going to have a little bit of a different experience. You're adjusting the stats as you go through, but then as you get into the game, you're also testing them. So what you're going to be able to do depends on your skill set and also your personality traits. So you don't want it to feel like you're constantly failing or that, that it's not supposed to be stressful. but it is supposed to have a sense that your choices matter, and what you have decided to be determines what you're able to do.
I definitely found that, first time I played it through, there were some points where I found it stressful because I was, as I said before, afraid that my character would die who I'd invested so much time through. But yeah, the second time around, I'm like, oh, then this is great. Like, just go with gut instincts, like, try something a bit different here. Is it a case of, with the first time, I feel I was trying to be more, like, measured with my decisions, whereas the second time, I'm more just like, nope, I'm just going to gun towards this one particular type of characterization. Have you found that people who tend to end up with, like, outcomes that they enjoyed, have you found that those people tend to just, like, double down on particular traits really strongly, or is there another approach? I'm just curious as to what the, I suppose, player response has been like for you, the author.
Yeah. I do find that, players come in different categories that way. So some players will play almost by instinct and say, okay, well, I'll just pretend that I'll imagine this character in my head, or maybe I'll even play as me if I were in this role in some way. And they'll make their, and then they'll see where they get. And other players will very consciously look at the stats screen, consider what the likely outcome of every choice is going to be, you know, yeah, and then decide, okay, well, if I do this, that'll probably raise my dexterity, and I need more dexterity, so I'll do this. And I think both methods are fine. I think some players have said, oh, you know, I had to play it 3 or 4 times before I could romance the person that I wanted, or, you know, where's the trick to this or that? And, you know, when you're writing the game, you're certainly not trying to trick people and not trying to make things impossible to get to, and, you know, we have a bunch of tests and things that we run to make sure there are ways to actually reach every option. But there's really no way to know in advance, you know, what every player's experience is going to be and how frustrating they're going to find a certain pathway or that kind of thing until it actually gets out into the world. And you just kind of have to accept that, you know, with every piece of fiction, it belongs to the reader in some way, you know, after it's out in the world. And with interactive fiction, that's even more the case because, yeah, people try to do things with it that I didn't anticipate, or, you know, the things that I thought would be easier are not as easy as I wanted them to be because the choices I thought people would make are not necessarily obvious. So it really sort of evolves and becomes what the players want it to be.
What is the most interesting thing that happened in readers playing through that you didn't anticipate?
I think the thing that always surprises me, or I mean, I say always, and it's only been 2 games, but in both games, what I'm gradually starting to learn is that for some players, romance is really important. And you know, which is great. And for me, it's part of the game, but it's not the central aspect of the game. Whereas there are a lot of players who take that probably as seriously or more seriously than any of the other outcomes. And so I have learned that, you know, a large percentage of the feedback will be about the romance options. And that's great. I think with my first game, I had fewer romance options and a little bit less devoted to that in general. And then in the second game, I realized from the feedback that, oh yeah, a lot of people really want this aspect to be in the game. And so I added a bit more of that in the second game. But I think even so, you know, there are some people who would like even more, for sure.
What's your personal favorite aspect of the game?
I think for me, getting back to the research and that sort of thing, I really liked being able to explore actual things that were happening in that society at that time and just have a little bit of fun with it, you know. So, of course, you know, Leonardo did invent a flying machine, and as far as we know, you know, never had any success with it. But you know, so being able to take that fact from history and say, okay, what if you had magic, and then what would the Renaissance flying machine have looked like if there was magic in the world? So just playing or taking things that were real, but playing with them and tweaking them a little bit was, you know, really fun for me. And just imagining how daily life in Florence would have changed if magic was part of that world. I also had a lot of fun with some of the characters in this one. You know, you mentioned there's a supernatural character who we don't ever learn very much about, but I kind of like those shadowy figures. They're fun to write, so that was lots of fun.
How do you manage character arcs in something where the character arcs are very dependent on reader choice?
Yeah, that is a huge question, and I struggled with that so much at the beginning, especially because with different endings, right? I mean, you know, I'm used to plotting out a book or a story that has an end, and frequently I start with the ending. I know where I'm going when I start plotting out a book. So not having that fixed point is really difficult, and especially for the character arc, because it's obviously a bit tricky. What I found is that I basically had to take either the external arc, the sort of external desire of the character, or the internal arc, and keep one of those things grounded in a sense. So what I mean by that is, in The Road to Canterbury, the character wants peace, very broadly defined. They want to find personal peace, and they're interested in geopolitical peace as well. But that could mean a lot of different things, and you could get there in a lot of different ways. So that internal arc, that finding of peace, stays the same no matter what choices you make, but it's sort of achieved through different paths. And in the Magician's Workshop, it's not quite as clear, but there's the character sort of has to come to deal with the role of secrets in their society, and the role of privacy and agency and community in their society, and they have to decide what their role in that is going to be, and they have to decide how they're going to be an artisan and guide the other apprentices in the workshop. So that's the same across all the different arcs, and I just had to think, okay, each choice the character makes is going to be moving them along that pathway in some direction, but there are three or four different things that could move them along that pathway. So it's almost like you're writing a story that's a braid or several different threads, but they're all moving in the same direction, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense, and I think that is a great approach, because yeah, you definitely get that sense that the character you're playing is like grappling with something important to them, and therefore it becomes important to you, I suppose. Does that same approach apply to the secondary characters, or is that a little bit different?
It does to some degree. They're especially in the Magician's Workshop, there are two other characters who are your rival apprentices in the workshop, and they're probably the most developed characters in the game, other than the player. They do have arcs in a sense, because their relationship with the character is defined by their own motivations and their own ambitions. On the flip side, what the player character does to those people affects how they'll respond and the choices that they'll make. So I did have those kind of moving parts to deal with as well, that if there's a character who you have not been talking to, you've been sort of keeping out of the loop and not sharing your secrets with, that person is probably going to want to become more ambitious and more secretive towards you. In that sense, their character arc responds to the player's character arc.
You mentioned a little bit earlier, and this is backing up, but I'm fascinated by this, that when you're writing for choice of games, they give you a set of guidelines to make a interactive fiction story that's fun to play. And I have played one other choice of games game as well, and I can definitely see some similarities in the player experience. Could you talk through some of those guidelines if it's possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to start out with, to sort of set the parameters. So Choice of Games has a programming language called ChoiceScript, and they have a certain style from a user interface perspective that you can use even if you're not writing for Choice of Games. So are these things called hosted games, which are just people using ChoiceScript to write their own games, but they're not Choice of Games products. So just to distinguish between that and a Choice of Games product, which is what I write. So a Choice of Games game does come with a set of guidelines, and they're basically a sort of philosophy of how their games work, so that there's a set of expectations for the players. It's not saying that other games are bad, it's just, you know, that you know if you're playing a Choice of Games game, this is what you're going to get. And they're pretty broad, but the main ones are that all of the choices have to be meaningful. So you can have the occasional, you know, is your cloak green, blue, or red kind of choice, but for the most part, what you're doing is really influencing the game in some way. So almost all of your choices should be affecting a stat or testing a stat or both. So you will actually be influencing what happens next with your choices. There are always three choices or more. You can never have a yes or no question, which can be very difficult. Because, you know, some things are yes or no questions. So sometimes you have to have a yes but or a no and or different options that way. You mentioned earlier that the character doesn't die, And that is not a hard and fast guideline, but they don't want an ending where in chapter two you decide to turn left rather than right, and oh, you step off a cliff and the end, right? Some games do have that kind of ending and can be a lot of fun, and you go back to the beginning and whatever, it's fine. But with Choice of Games, they decided that they don't want that kind of ending. So you can have an ending that is a death or a failure in some sense to achieve what you wanted, but all of the endings have to be satisfying, and they have to come towards the end of the game. So you can die, but it's got to be fairly late in the game, and the death has got to be meaningful in some way. It's got to feel like the end of a story, that, yeah, he closed the book, and okay, I died, but that was a good story. And they also have a lot of guidelines about the ethics of character choice. There's not going to be a Choice of Games game where, topics like sexual assault and that kind of thing, they're dealt with very carefully. All Choice of Games products allow you to play, do I have to nuance that it's all? I'm pretty sure all Choice of Games products allow you to play as various genders and various sexualities as well. And it's also very important that all of the secondary characters are diverse, appropriate to their setting, obviously, but as diverse as the writer can make them. So they have a bunch of guidelines like that, so that the players, because there are quite a few people who are really big fans of just Choice of Games, and they'll play every game that comes out every month, and it's amazing to me how dedicated some of these people are, which is great. They have a forum and everything, and talk about it. So it's nice for them to know that they're basically not going to get slapped in the face by a Choice of Games product. They know, you know, they're all very different settings, different writers, everything, but there are certain core elements that are going to be the same.
Excellent. Yeah, those are really useful. And you can definitely see a lot of those picking up. I think the having meaningful choices aspect of it has been interesting for me personally, because I suppose when you're writing linear fiction, like a novel, it's very easy to have long stretches where characters don't make choices and where there's very little agency displayed on their part. And while that can be fine in some stories, like Catcher of the Rye, for instance, is an example of a story where there's not much character agency and not many choices, whereas something that is more of like, I don't know, like a detective or thriller thing is basically oriented around the choices in that book. What have been some of the writing lessons that interactive fiction has taught you in terms of linear fiction? Has there been much crossover?
Definitely there has. I think part of that is the character agency thing. I used to really struggle with character motivation in fiction in general. And I say used to rather hopefully. I think some of these struggles, you know, never go away. But, motivation has always been really central to me to try and get my head around, because when I started out, I didn't really have that strong sense of characters who wanted something and would work to get it and would change. So learning how to use that skill set in my fiction was really, really big for me. So Choice of Games writing has helped me to really develop that skill further and to think about what would a character do, because the choices can't just be what would the player do, but they would also be what would be appropriate for this character to do in this moment, and they can't just come out of the blue and be weird choices. So that's really helped. And I think another way that it's helped me is to really learn how to play around with structure and storytelling. Because I think I had this tendency to think early on that, that there was one ideal version of the story that was being kept in a book up in the sky. And if only I could glimpse it, I would know what the story was supposed to be. But unfortunately, as a mortal, I had to struggle to get it, you know. And I kind of realized with writing interactive fiction that there is no ideal version of my story, mm-hmm. that the story can be what I want it to be, that I am the god of that universe, and some choices are interesting and some choices are less so, and some are better and some are worse, but I can play and I can change things around and it's not going to break anything. So tinkering a little bit with plot and with structure, because when you write a game, there is canonically no one version of the story. You know, it is written to be multiple versions, and so Now when I write a novel, I have a sense that, okay, there are different ways that I could write this book. And I have to pick one, but it's not like I'm going to make a wrong choice. It's just going to be a different choice.
And also readers are never going to know what the other choices are in a linear fiction piece as well.
Exactly, exactly. Nobody knows that you got it wrong. There is no getting it wrong, really.
And I think that's so liberating as well, because especially during the first draft, it's very easy. I find it very easy for me personally to be like, this is abysmal, not enjoying this at all, it's going to be a bad story. But then by the time it gets to 6th draft, 7th draft, 8th draft, whatever, readers are like, oh, this is great. And you're like, you'll never know how hard I was paddling under the water to make that happen. But that's really good as well. More generally, exactly. What is the biggest writing lesson that you have learned over the years, if you had to narrow it down?
Oh, gosh. Think about that. I think it comes back to that character motivation piece, because that seems to be what I keep pulling myself toward whenever I get stuck. Years ago, I want to say maybe even 20 years ago or close to it, I had one of my first rejections on a short story, and it was on paper, and it was from a literary journal. And I can't even remember which one, but I can still see it in my mind's eye. And it was just a form rejection, you know, typed up. But at the bottom, the editor had written in pen, you write beautifully. Now try telling a story in which someone wants something and they change, or that people want something and they change. And I thought, oh, okay. And it's funny because it came from a literary journal. It wasn't genre fiction. And, you know, but even in literary fiction, that idea that, okay, well, maybe my character should want something, maybe my character should change, and I can't just tell this pretty vignette that I was, I got good at writing these sort of, you know, very static vignettes without any character agency, without that sense of motion and change. So I think that was probably the biggest shift for me in storytelling, is understanding that it doesn't matter how many, you know, plot structures I have, or, you know, like you said, like the corkboard with the thread and all that stuff. You know, what it really comes down to is always remembering that the character is driving the story, and what the character wants is driving the story. And whenever I remind myself of that, then I can push everything else away, and it becomes much easier to tell the story as it's meant to be.
Thank you for that. That is, I think, something that is very easy to lose, to lose sight of, because it's such a basic thing that we're told, but it's so easy to be, I guess, like, enamored with the world you're exploring, or to think that you're doing something really clever with structure and plot, and to, you know, lose. I think it was, who was it that said, it might be Ray Bradbury that said something along the lines of, every character should want something, even if it's just a glass of water. And I think that might have been his number one piece of advice, too. So yeah, that definitely, I appreciate that. That is a really good point. What do you think is your biggest writing strength and your biggest writing weakness?
It's funny, because I think they're almost the same things, come to think of it. Because I think I had weaknesses that I worked on really hard, and now they're the things that get compliments on.
So, interesting.
I think the things that were weaknesses of mine 10 years ago are now the things that I would describe as my strengths, which is good, I think, in a way. I mean, it's kind of heartening that, you know, we can actually get better at things. So what I'm thinking of specifically are immersion in a world. And I, you know, description and that kind of thing don't come naturally to me. If I just sit down and write the way that I want to write, it's almost like a screenplay. I'll write a lot of dialogue in a white room, you know, there'll be ideas in there, but it won't feel like a real place. So I really, really worked on that. And now I get a lot of compliments on, oh, you know, it really feels real, and it feels like I'm living in this world, which is what I'm trying to do. So that's really great that people are telling me that. And the other thing that I really had to work on was emotion, because I got a lot of rejections early on that will be familiar to a lot of listeners, I'm sure, which is the old, this was great, but I can't connect with the characters, right? And you, what does that mean? Can't connect with the characters. And, you know, for a long time, I thought it was a problem with the characters themselves, that there was something wrong with these characters I created. And eventually I figured out that for me, what was happening was that the language I was using was really distancing. And I was keeping the narrative distance. The sort of the camera of the story was really far back. And I wasn't really thinking about emotion and motivation for my characters very much. So I really worked on that for years and years about how to really use, at a sentence level, how to get into the minds of my characters a little bit more and to explore their emotion in different ways. And I'm still working on that. But now I actually have people who tell me that, you know, I just handed in my novel, my latest novel, to my editor a couple of weeks ago, and apparently I made him cry.
Wow, congrats. So, that was awesome.
Yes, exactly. Achievement unlocked. I made my editor cry.
That's such a writer. That's such a writer thing to be happy about. Is like, I can think of no other job in the world where you would be happy to make someone cry. But writing, it's.
Yes, I was so pleased. Yeah, so that was something I think I wouldn't have been able to do 10 years ago. That I was interested in language and in ideas, but I was not. I was not really conversant in emotion and character. And so I think I've worked on that now and now I have a lot more fun with it as well.
What has allowed you to be successful as a writer?
Oh gosh.
Very big question. I know.
Yeah. I think it's a combination of luck and persistence, you know, as it is for probably most of us, you know, and when I say luck, I don't just mean random chance. I mean, of course, there's privilege built into it, and there's probably networking and that kind of thing too. Although for the most part, I think it's just, you know, most of my opportunities have come the very old-fashioned way of you sending out submissions, sending out query letters cold. But I've just done it a lot and kept doing it even when it seemed very unlikely that I was going to get anywhere. So, yeah, I think persistence is the thing that's helped to get me where I am now, because I've been writing for, you know, 20 years seriously, and for a long time I wasn't really getting anywhere, and I sort of reached this point in my life where I thought, okay, this might not actually happen for me. I have to accept that this might not happen for me. I might not be able to publish a book traditionally. I might just never get there. Do I want to keep writing? And the answer was yes, that I just really love writing. So I said, okay, you know what, I'm just going to keep writing, and I'll keep sending things out, and maybe it won't happen, but what choice do I have if I love doing this, you know? So I think that's the difference between that path that I took, because then I did get an agent, and everything worked out fine. But another path, you know, conceiving of my life as interactive fiction would have been to say, you know what, no, it's not worth it. I'm going to, you know, take up the cello instead or something.
What does your writing process look like these days?
I'm really lucky these days because I don't have a day job anymore. Because I quit. I used to work at a newspaper, and I quit in 2015 to go freelance. And so now I make my living in all kinds of different ways. I teach and I edit, and, you know, like many of us, sort of cobbling together a living in various ways. And writing is getting to be a bigger and bigger piece of that pie every year, that I can spend more time writing because I'm actually making some money from it now. So what that means is that nowadays I actually tend to write during daylight hours, which is a marvelous luxury. Yeah. And when my kid goes off to school, that's my best time for writing because the house is quiet. And I don't have anything else on the go. So if I'm not editing for someone on deadline, for a client on deadline, or I'm not marking papers or something like that, then the sort of next thing on my list will be writing. And I'll often write for about 4 hours when he's at school. And then once he comes home and the house gets a little bit noisier, I'll turn to, you know, editing for a client or things that I can do that aren't on deadline, but I need to get done. So it's sort of a weird mix. I write at home on my laptop, and Sometimes I will go to a coffee shop or the library, and I have some friends in Ottawa who are also either don't have day jobs or are full-time writers. So sometimes we'll get together and write either at a house or in a coffee shop, and that's fantastic because just having other people, even though we don't talk very much, you know, just having other people writing is a great way to produce.
So wrapping this up, one last question that I am always endlessly fascinated by because it produces very different answers, I suppose, from various authors, is I want you to imagine, this is very interactive fiction as well, I want you to imagine at the end of your life, hopefully it's been a very long and happy life, you are looking back on all of the books you've written, all the games you've produced and everything. What do you hope that your legacy as a writer will be?
Oh, yeah, that is a tough one. Yeah, I think it sort of comes down to a moment when I try to distill what I want out of my books, what I want out of my relationship with readers. You know, that moment when you're reading a book and you have to stop and you kind of look out the window for a minute, you know, and I think that moment that a reader has when they're reading something that I've written and they have to stop and they have to think for a second. And I like the idea that long after I'm dead, somebody will be at a cottage somewhere or a B&B somewhere, and there'll be some battered paperback on the shelf by some writer they've never heard of, and it's me, you know, and they pick it up and they thumb through it on the beach, and they have that moment for whatever it means to them. So, yeah, I think that would be fantastic if it happens.
I love that response. That's incredible. Kate, thanks so much for coming on the show. Can you let listeners know where's the best place to find you, what's sort of the next project coming out from you, and all that good stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So best place to find me, sadly I'm on Twitter far too much, so you can find me there. I'm just Kate Hartfield, HEARTFIELD on Twitter. My website is katehartfield.com or hartfieldfiction.com. Both of them will get you there. And what I have coming out next, this year I don't have a whole lot coming out. Next year, the book that I just handed in that made my editor cry is called The Embroidered Book, which is it's another historical fantasy, and it's actually about Marie Antoinette and her sister as magicians. So lots of research there. So that's coming out from Harper Voyager UK next summer, in the summer of 2021. And I think before that, I'm just going to be sort of lying low and working on another novel. And yeah, that's about it.
Excellent. Kate, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to my interview with Kate Hartfield. I would love if you could let me know what was the number one takeaway that you took away from this episode. Whether that's a writing lesson, whether that's a piece of motivation, whether that's a different way of looking at storytelling that this episode helped you understand, I would really love if you could let me know by either tweeting me. I'm on Twitter at Jed Hearn, JedHearne, or you can send me an email. My email address is jed.hearne1@gmail.com. That's jed.hearne1@gmail.com, and I will read and respond to all of those. Just make sure that you mention this episode, and I will do my best to reply to all of those, because I'm very fascinated to hear what are the things that you took away from this episode that will hopefully be helpful to you in your writing. And now, time to wrap another episode of the Novel Analyst Podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and now go and write extraordinary stories. I'll see you next time.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.